it's just fine.
Right.
We're going to try this with the microphone off. And
can you hear a word I'm saying? Most people can't. You can't hear me.
Yeah.
Amazing. Must have been my hours of voice projection lessons.
So, Charles, how did you get started as a writer? First of all, you're Australian.
Not no, British.
British.
Please.
You spent a good deal of your youth in Australia, though.
A comparative youth, shall we say.
All right.
Anyway, I began in England, and my first brush with a murder case was in, dare I say it, 1947, when I was, I'm happy to say, still at school. And my grandmother was living in a very nice hotel called the Royal Court Hotel in London, in Kensington. And she was being paid court to, because she was a widow, by an attractive youngish man who was flattering her excessively. And we were very suspicious of this man. I felt there was something definitely questionable about him. He'd been up to no good. And we warned her, and to tell the story briefly, put her off this gentleman completely, and she finally gave up on the idea of marrying him as her second husband. Anyway, one morning, my mother picked up the London paper, probably one of the more lurid papers to which she was addicted, and the cover had her going as white as a sheet, famous white as a sheet cliché, and it was the person's face, and over it was the headline, widow murderer caught in Kensington. And it was John Joseph Haig who became world infamous as a famous murderer of the 1940s. And so she was saved by the traditional bell, namely my mother and I, who discouraged her. So this fascinated me. Here was an innocuous person, charming, a little questionable, but could easily have been my step grandfather who was murdering women and dropping them in an acid bath. And briefly, there's a little epilogue to the tale. I told this to Alfred Hitchcock, who could never be upstaged in anything, and he expressed considerable interest in the story. Needless to say, in several films he'd put mentions of of Haig under disguise. He always liked to use real cases. "I can beat that, my boy," he said. I said, "Well, I'm sure you can, Mr. Hitchcock." He said, "I knew the hanging judge that condemned him, Mr. Justice Goddard." And he said, "Mr. Goddard Jr. called me one day in London and said, 'Do you know where Mr. Justice Goddard wants to retire?' And I said, 'No.' 'He wants to retire to the Onslow Court Hotel where John Joseph Haig dropped the widow in the acid bath and stay in the same suite.'" So that was his kappa. I couldn't beat that one.
So you left England, you went to Australia where you began a career in journalism.
Yes, true.
And then you, as you told me, you began covering the films as well. You were a poet.
Film critic and columnist, and published several books of poetry in Australia, and was invited by the University of California at Santa Cruz to come in as Regents Professor and Writer in Residence, where it would be too long a story for today, but due to a fluke, I was invited to do a book on Orson Welles and found his lost movie, It's All True, set in South America in a vault at Paramount. The reason I found it was that Hazel Marshall, who was in charge of the archive, she'd been Cecil B. DeMille's cutter, mistook me for a stock footage buyer in San Jose called Hyams, H-Y-A-M-S. So by this sheer fluke, I got the lost footage of this lost masterpiece, It's All True, and it put me on the map in America. I never went back to Australia because Newsweek did a big feature on me, the film detective. I found the lost film in the vault, quite by chance. So that got me going. And then my book came out, The Films of Orson Welles, and the New York Times asked me to be their Hollywood correspondent.
And so that's when you started to go bad.
I've never recovered
and,
since.
And to do
never
this sort of thing.
Since.
So,
absolutely.
Clearly detecting was something that was in your blood. You've enjoyed searching down mysteries. One of the first and most controversial of your books was about Errol Flynn.
Yes.
And
controversial, to say the least.
Tell us about
I wasn't telling the truth. That is controversial.
Tell us about your investigations of Flynn and
yes. Well, I'd written the entire book for the great Ken McCormick, the editor emeritus of Doubleday, who was a genius of an editor. And I delivered it, and he loved the book, was going to publish it right away, when someone called me to say they had a tip on a character called Dr. Herman Urban, who friend of Flynn's, I put down as no more than a random picaresque adventurer in New Guinea. It turned out that he was the chief witness at the Nazi spy trials of Shanghai in 1945, and he was in fact revealed as being himself a prominent Nazi. He'd started as a stormtrooper, the murder of Dollfuss in Austria, and he had a long career as a Nazi. And I thought, why would Errol Flynn be remotely interested in a convinced and active Nazi? At that time, the Freedom of Information Act had just been ratified. It was started under President Johnson. And I went to Washington. I was among the first half dozen scholars to go into the archive. And I looked immediately for cards in the suspicious activities section on Flynn and Dr. Urban. And there were an incredible number of cards marked subversive activities on both persons. That led me, it would take all day and several nights to tell you the story, but basically it led me into finding out over the next several months into a year that Errol Flynn was a great deal more than just a friend of a Nazi agent. He was collaborative with that Nazi agent. The State Department files from Spain were conclusive. They showed that he'd gone behind the lines of the loyalist government, which was against Franco and Hitler. He had obtained the names and addresses as a visiting movie star of the members of the Theilmann Brigade, which was Hitler's brigade that had left Hitler to join the loyalist government. And as a result, the families of those people whose names he supplied were tortured to death and killed in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And so his activities were similar to Kim Philby, who was famous, of course, for being a communist pretending to work for Franco. Flynn was famous for being a Franco supporter behind the loyalist lines. So this was all kept very, very dark. It was known in all circles, both in Hollywood and out of it. And then, of course, it led me to a long, merry chase that finally disclosed the exact details of Flynn's enormously elaborate Nazi connection. I'm just beginning to do a new edition. Very briefly, Cynthia Gorney, who I think won a Pulitzer, certainly she was one of the top writers of the Washington Post, was sent by the famous editor Ben Bradley of All the President's Men to interview me and go through the documents, because Mr. Bradley, as like all good journalists and editors, was basically skeptical of this. It all seemed highly improbable. And Robert Lindsay of the New York Times, the author of The Falcon and the Snowman, both came to see me, and they went away and wrote totally confirmative pieces based on their own exhaustive collection of evidence. More than I knew, actually. They put in a lot of new information about Flynn's Nazi activities I didn't know. So the book came out, and of course people were screaming and hysterical. But now it seems to have entered finally, at least into Hollywood lore, if not actual history, as an accepted fact. It took all those years.
Didn't you end up in a leper colony after this adventure?
Well, you better be careful shaking my hand. No, I did not. I found Dr. Herman Urban. What happened was that I had to find him, obviously. He'd been deprived of his citizenship in 1940. He had been kicked out of this country as an undesirable alien and Nazi activist. And I had to find him. Where was he? And I thought, given his usual cheek, he's probably still listed in the American Medical Association foreign listings. I thought that's very, would be typical of him. And believe it or not, even though he'd long since been struck from the register in utter disgrace, he was still listed in Vienna. So I called Vienna repeatedly. I finally reached a voice that responded. And a woman said, this is Hilda Schnerch. I said, well, this is Miss or Mrs. Schnerch. Could you please tell me where Dr. Urban is? He's in a leper colony in the Philippines. What do you want him for? I said, well, he's wanted for an investigation. And it's very important I reach him at once. He said, "Well, if you go up there, you'll get leprosy. I don't want you to know." So I thought, this isn't exactly what I'm looking for. So I, this is going to take us all day, but very briefly, I found a certain Marcus Aguayo out of a list of 26 journalists who spoke English in Manila from the Philippine consulate on Wilshire Boulevard. And I literally, believe it or not, and you probably won't, picked the name out with a pin. And it turned out he was Dr. Urban's field worker, and his mother was Dr. Urban's assistant in the leper colony. So I sent him up there through a raging storm to get the story, and we came back with 27 hours of admissions by Dr. Urban of his association with Errol Flynn. End of story. I think.
Fascinating.
Unless we're going to be here all day.
The one of your recent books was an extended biography of the Duchess of Windsor.
Indeed it was.
And this led you into another famous murder case of the 1930s?
1943. Sir Harry Oakes was the most, among the half dozen wealthiest people in the world in 1943. After years as a struggling gold prospector, he had struck gold in the Yukon and the equivalent of the motherlode. I mean, the man was incredibly wealthy and he lived in the tax-free zone of Nassau in the Bahamas. And he had a close friend, Harold Christie, who was a questionable character who owned a lot of land in the Bahamas. And Harold Christie had double-crossed Sir Harry Oakes in selling off some land, which he was supposed to be a partner of Oakes with, to American Air Force as a base, as a flying base. So he double-crossed him. And Oakes found out and called in his IOUs and was going to ruin him. Now, the question was, there were rumours of this, of that he had murdered Oakes, but I had no evidence. So I went to Nassau to solve the case. The reason it came into the Windsor book is the Duke and Duchess of Windsor were governor and governor's lady of the Bahamas in 1943. And they had a vested interest, of course, in this whole case. They'd already had a black riot in the islands. They didn't want any more trouble. But trouble they got because of this murder. Now, I went there to investigate the murder. It had been put down in the newspapers at the time, in the middle of the war, you know. It was scarcely a headline item, but it was, that he had been killed by gunshot. I didn't believe it. There was something fishy. You get an instinct about these things. So I went to the archive in Nassau, if you can call it that. It was a cellar haunted by termites and other disagreeable things, and the files were in a shambles, piled up in corners, and this was the archive. It was just a mess, and it had been subject to hurricane damage and never knows what all. And I said to this very charming lady in a bandana, I said, "May I please look around?" And she said, well, you have to contribute to the Nassau Charity Fund. I gave her £50 in local currency. And for this simple bribe, I was allowed to explore the various... And I finally, of course, with my usual luck, I found the file on the case, eaten, half-eaten away, but still be actually read. Chased away a lizard and a spider, and there I was. So anyway, I read it and took it with me, and it showed that he was not killed by a bullet, but by a triangular weapon, five times in a crescent form behind the left ear. It was in the form of like a trident. It was a three-cornered weapon. A horrible thing. It went right through the mastoid bone and killed him instantly. And he was then subjected to burning by gunpowder. So, to cut an immensely long story short, again, we'd be here all day, I took this massive documentation, photographs of the deceased, the lies that were told at the trial, that a man called Alfred de Marigny, who was his nephew, was charged with his murder, and completely without any evidence at all, very nearly was hanged, was acquitted at the last minute, fled the islands in terror. But essentially, I took this to various people. I took it to Dr. Joseph Choi, who was Noguchi's assistant and was the chief forensic pathologist in Los Angeles at the time. It's now Dr. Lakshanan, as many of you all know. I took it to other people, including John Ball, the famous author of In the Heat of the Night, now sadly deceased, and Sergeant Louis Danoff, head of LA Homicide, and New York detectives, too numerous to list. And the result was that this was definitely a ritual murder. He had been murdered by a Palomayombe hired killer. It was the traditional form of the crescent moon behind the left ear of the spear in honor of Elagua, the Palomayombe deity. And I solved the case. Then I went to Houston to meet with the accused, Alfred de Marigny. He got off the plane. To my amazement, he and his wife were there to greet me off the plane, very unusual. And he went to get my luggage, and she said to me, Mrs. de Marigny said to me, Mr. Higham, do you think my husband did it? I said, after 34 years of marriage, you don't even know? And she said, I'm still not sure. So I said, put your mind at ease. She's done by a Palomayombe. What's that? She said, I'll explain to you at dinner. So at the dinner that night, I told them what he had never known, which was the solution of the murder.
Wow. Is Murder in Hollywood another one?
Yes. Murder in Hollywood is a rare case where I met the murderess before I started the book. There's a certain novelty value in this, I think. In 1971 or so, when I first settled in Hollywood, I got a call from Milton Lubavitsky, who, as some of you will remember, ran the fabulous Larry Edmonds bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard. And he said to me, Mary Marsminter wants a book written about her. Are you interested? She, of course, was a famous movie star who was accused, along with Mabel Normand, the great comedy star, of being involved in the murder of William Desmond Taylor, the celebrated director in 1922. So I said, would I be interested? Where does she live? I'll be there right now. So within minutes, I was driving to Santa Monica. He called her, and I was on the way to Santa Monica. And she greeted me, and she looked like Baby Jane. She had she had cupid bow lips. She had blonde kiss curls from the 20s. And a fall, a long blonde fall. And she was dressed in a gingham dress with marigolds on it and puff sleeves and pink shoes with pom-poms on them. And she took me into her living room and she said, you like Longfellow? Well, I did not. If I ever hear Hiawatha again, I'll throw up. But she said, unless you like Hiawatha, you can't do my life story. Unless you do Hiawatha. I said, what do you mean do it? She said, recite it. I said, I can't recite it. I'll be happy to read it. So she made me read Hiawatha. 2.5 hours later, I was still barely alive. But anyway, basically, she said that she took me there to tell me that she had not killed William Desmond Taylor, and that he'd been killed by two boys down the street who were escaping from a gas station robbery and hid in the house, and he found them and they shot him. Absolute rubbish from beginning to end. There wasn't a trace of truth in any of it. But I let it go. Anyway, the following morning, she had not been out of that house for 30 years, allegedly. Her maid, who did all the shopping for her, took care of everything. Anyway, the following morning, I woke up and I heard a violent honking outside my window. I looked out and there was £300 Mary Marsminter in a Volkswagen. It must have taken a major feat of engineering to get her into it. I don't know how it was done. Anyway, so her maid hobbled up my path and said, Mr. Higham, Miss Minter's changed her mind. She thinks she said too much. Can I have the tape back? I said, happily, I'd already made a copy of it, of course. So I gave her the original and kept the copy. And to this day, of course, it proved very valuable in the long run. But anyway, so she got the copy back. The maid said, who was German, she said, she has panicked, she has frightened, she is terrified of you. I said, why? We've had a good time. She says she feels she said too much. And too much indeed she had said, as it later emerged. Anyway, briefly, it's hard to be brief in the story, but King Vidor, the famous director, decided to do a book on the subject, and he did. It wasn't, to be honest, and he's not with us anymore, I shouldn't say it, but it wasn't very good. Anyway, I took it to Robert Giroux, the famous publisher of Farrar, Straus and Giroux, who said that since they'd accused Mary Marsminter of mother of the murder and had no proof, he couldn't publish it. Several years later, Sidney Kirkpatrick brought out a book on the case, which was equally fraudulent and silly, And he brought out this statement again that the book should have been written. He said in his review of the book in the New York Times Book Review that this book should have been written by King Vidor. So I was obliged to point out that he'd rejected the King Vidor book in the first place. So that seemed to be rather an unwise statement. Anyway, very briefly, if I can be brief, the case went on and on and on, and I finally decided to do it myself because I found the police files that King had given me many, many years later. That was about 3 or 4 years ago, and decided it was time to do the book and do it thoroughly this time, really do it properly. So I got hold of all of the appropriate people that knew Taylor. Do I have time to tell a quick story?
Yeah.
I think I do. I went to this party, and I met two of the people who were close to him, Mae McAvoy, who was the star with Al Jolson as a jazz singer, and Corinne Griffith, who was a popular star of the silent era, who told me she was not Corinne Griffith. And I said, well, then who are you? She said, I'm Mary Griffith. I took over from my sister when she died in the middle of a picture. Mr. Adolf Stukor told me that I was almost a twin and no one would know the difference. And they didn't, so she claimed. A little far-fetched, but nice to hear. So anyway, at the party, I met the two of them, and they hadn't seen each other for decades. And Corinne Griffith said to Mary, Mae McAvoy, Mae, I thought you were dead. And Mae said, Corinne, I thought you were alive. Anyway, so I got talk to everybody, and I found the police files and went through it all, and I found out the very person I talked to first, Mary Miles Minter, was the murderess. It would ruin the book if I were to tell you the intricate process with which I established her undoubted guilt. But one of the biggest helpers I had of all was the aforementioned Dr. Lakshanan, the indispensable county coroner of Los Angeles from Madras, who seldom, if ever, gives an interview, but I managed to ask him to, and he did. And we went over all of the photographs of the deceased, the circumstances of the death. The body was found at 7:30 in the morning, and it was claimed to give Mary Miles Minter an alibi, because the studio was protecting her, that he had died at 7:30 the previous evening. But many of you, most of you, if not all of you, will know that at a temperature of 32 degrees, and it was very, very cold in Los Angeles, phenomenally cold that week, that the body would be in rigor mortis. There's no way that the arm could be stretched out and the body rearranged and in rigor mortis in that length, of time would have brought rigor mortis. So I was able to establish, through going over all the evidence with Dr. Lakshanan, the actual murder took place between 1 o'clock and 2 in the morning. And this was crucial because they had done this to establish her alibi. She had no alibi for between 1 and 2 in the morning at all. But she did have an alibi for between 7 and 8. So they covered it. The inquest covered it. The investigation covered it. And the fact that there were tufts of her hair, you know, threads of her hair, like single hairs were found on the dead man's lapel, these were removed in order to hide her guilt. All the fingerprints were removed. Everything was covered up in the most amazingly detailed way. And she got away with it, essentially, all those years. So you can understand when she engages a British writer to do a story, and then she starts telling him her version of the facts, and somewhere in the middle of the evening after he leaves, she realizes that he probably knows too much. You can see the total panic that would drive her to force herself by engineering into a Volkswagen and make her way to my home.
Charles, where do these subjects come from for you? You've written about so many diverse people. I mean, obviously the film industry has been a fascination.
Yes.
But Jenny Churchill,
yes,
and others, Conan Doyle, have nothing to do with the film industry. How do you pick out what you're going to write about?
Well, I suppose serendipity is my middle name. I mean, I'm fascinated by almost everything. And also, a lot of these things lead from one thing to another, like, for instance, the Mary Miles Minter suggestion. I wouldn't have dreamed of asking to meet this incredible person. I didn't even know she was alive in 1970. So that was a fluke, really. And the Windsor thing came out of my research on the Windsors. And as an Englishman, of course, we're all deeply fascinated by the royal family, for better or worse. And the Windsors have always had a sort of exotic fascination because of their outrageous antics in going to see Hitler when you didn't do that sort of thing, and so forth and so on. So I can't really explain, and to go book by book, we'd be here until 6 o'clock, and the Academy Awards will be on. So I'll have to dodge it. I'll try not to be dodgy next time.
Well, it sounds like you should have been a detective, not just a writer.
I'm glad you added that. When people say you should have been a detective, I hope the implication is that you would have been a better detective than a writer.
International bestsellers, those are hard to argue with. So, I think we're going to open it up
yes,
at this point for questions from the audience.
It's the silence.
Everybody's thinking now about which questions they're going to ask.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a new edition of Errol Flynn, which will contain all of the information that came to light after the book was published from other witnesses. For instance, the people surrounding Carol Chessman, who, in Carol Chessman, had a lawyer, Rosalie Asher, in sense. She's no longer living unhappily in Sacramento. And she had another fine man, George T. Davis, in San Francisco. They gave me very long interviews about how they went to see Carol Chessman towards the end of his life in the death cell. Mm-hmm. And cell 2455 Death Row, San Quentin. And they told me that all the facts in the memoirs of Carol Chessman, cell 2455 Death Row, concerning a certain Mr. Christopher, were in fact relating to Errol Flynn. This was a Nazi, a star who was actually a Nazi, but was a star in disguise, disguised as a star. Was keeping up these activities in Mexico, and he went to Mexico. So there are a lot of things like that. A lot of new material has come in on this, not really for another book. What I think I'll do, instead of doing a film book this time, because it had to be rewritten rather awkwardly from scratch, this time I think it will be purely on the political history of Errol Flynn, based upon... And now, in the last few weeks, as I'm sure many of you know, the FBI has released an incredible number of documents never previously available to the National Archive. Fortunately, John Taylor is an old friend of mine there, and he's given me a very good situation in the waiting list, and I've just got a huge batch of stuff on Errol Flynn, which I'm combing through, but it's very confirmative and very detailed.
What about writing detective fiction?
Yes, I've just written, and my wonderful agent, Whitney Lee, has a copy of it. My first mystery novel. I've written a story, a kind of sinister fairy tale, not at all like Stephen King. It's a different kind of story, but it's about a changeling in Ireland who returns to a family with a very sinister intent. That has been optioned for a film by a producer called Ian Levy. But this new novel, Red for Danger, is set in London in the 1880s, and it concerns it has a very strong contemporary parallel, because it deals with the terrorist activities of the Irish-American dynamiters in London in the 1880s and 90s, and how they tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament. They tried to have a new kind of Guy Fawkes night, and it's about how the detective in my story uncovers the plot to bomb London from the inside and manages to stop it happening.
When you're writing from reality
yes.
involved with a particularly depraved case with perpetrators of very depraved states of mind,
yes.
do you feel any emotional difficulty of your own as a result of having to put yourself into their shoes or look through their eyes?
Very much so. The Errol Flynn thing came as a tremendous shock to me. People refuse to believe this. They think I rubbed my hands and thought, bestseller immediately. But when I got word from this person I mentioned was making a film about Dr. Erman, showing him as the chief informer at the Shanghai spy trials, showing Dr. Erman as that person, and then I linked Errol Flynn to Dr. Erman, irrevocably showing that Errol Flynn was involved in this terrible expedition to Spain to betray the Thälmann Brigade that left Hitler for the Loyalists. It was a terrible shock to me. People just refused to believe this, but I swear it's true, because like most men of my generation, I had grown up with Errol Flynn as my hero, you know, Robin Hood. We would all run around at school with bows and arrows and wooden knives, you know, carrying on, and in the playgrounds. And we loved the idea of Errol Flynn. I mean, he was incredible. We never thought through that he was an Irish terrorist, he was involved with the IRA. We never would have known all that. And if we had, we wouldn't have had him as a hero. So it came as an emotional shock, and that year was one of the worst years of my life. Because I was hoping it would all turn out not to be true. I was fighting against the facts all the time. And then finally, I called Ken McCormick, who was my brilliant editor, sort of Maxwell Perkins of a later hour. And I said, I don't think I can go on with this. It's affecting me too badly. You know, this was an emotional connection. And he said, you have to do this. It's very important politically. It will show a whole set of things that people don't know about. And he really forced my hand, and the book was very difficult. And of course, it was even worse when it came out. Also, this is absolute rubbish. How could Errol Flynn possibly be a Nazi agent? It's nonsensical. So I had to deal with all that. I was on all of the major. You could only do Today or Good Morning America, as you know. I was on Good Morning America. Now I was on Today's show with Gene Shalit, and got a lot of flack on these shows. But then something incredible happened, which I must tell you about. I was in San Francisco on the Owen Spann show, which at that stage was the biggest radio show in California. And a woman called in. He was giving me a very hard time, and I understood why. And a woman called in and said, I can confirm every word Mr. Haim is saying. He said, what are you talking about? Are you a friend of Mr. Haim's? Is this a plant? You know, very rude. No, no, I've never met Mr. Haim. She said, I want justice to be done. She said, I was in charge of the Errol Flynn files in London between 1940 and 1945 at MI5, which was the British intelligence headquarters in Curzon Street. So to give her off, he wanted to cut her off, but I said loudly to his live audience, do not cut her off, Mr. Spann. Your audience wants to hear her. And so I did a test question, because I wanted to establish her authenticity, not only for myself, if she wasn't some kind of a nut calling out of the Bay Area, but she was a really authentic person. I said, would you please tell me the exact address in Curzon Street? She said, 16 Curzon Street. I knew it was right, because my father's offices were on 21 Curzon Street. So I knew it was right, that that's where, as a child, I would be walked past the spy headquarters. It was a big thrill for a child. Then I said, what was the file? Can you describe the file? She said, it's a manila folder with a red ribbon around it, marked most secret. If she said top secret, I knew she was lying, but most secret is a correct designation, and it was stamped. And I said, she even remembered the stamp. Can you imagine that, after all those many years, after 30 years? And I knew she was authentic, so I got her phone number on the air. He didn't want it, but I got it. Called her. And she said, I want to discuss this with you because you've been given such a hard time. She said, I was in charge. And she told me how what was in the file, his Nazi connections, the fact that he brought the Irish Republican Army under the Nazi government, switched it over from the communists who'd been backing it to Hitler, and Hitler was behind the IRA through the entire World War II, planning to invade England from Ireland. And the story was incredible. Anyway, I thought, well, how am I ever going to get my hands on this file, given British secrecy? Well, an incredible fluke occurred. I got a call from Jerry Brown, who's a hotshot journalist working for the Murdoch, what is today would be the Murdoch organization, the News of the World, which is a terrible paper, but often had great scoops. And I want a story. I said, look, if you can get the story of that file and the IRA Nazi connection, this is major news. It'll be front page everywhere in the world. Get it, and I'll give it to you. It's yours. And he said, I can get it. I said, how can you do that? He said, because I worked for Ministry of Defence in Ireland, in the Welsh Guards, and they love me, and they will give me access to this file. And he called Sir Francis Pym, the Home Secretary, Ministry of Defence, and they gave him 2 hours with the file. He was not allowed to take a copy of it. It was directly in infringement of the British Official Secrets Act. For 2 hours, he sat there making exhaustively detailed notes and called me with them. It was exactly the same file. The number, the description, the manila folder, the red ribbon, the most secret, exactly what Anne Lane had seen in 1940. Can you imagine this? It was the same file, and it was far more than I ever knew. And that was the basis, basically, of my book.
Charles, when you do your research, do you farm any of it out to other people? Do you do it all yourself?
Well, I have stringers everywhere because in economical terms, it is very expensive, especially now, to travel anywhere. We all know that to our cost. Not to mention the discomforts of travel, but that's another issue. It's always been fairly uncomfortable. Now it's very uncomfortable. But the main thing is to have stringers because people you can trust can do the work at a fraction of the cost you would incur, a fraction. And so therefore, it's far better to have stringers. They can send you material, they can piece it all together, and of course you'll double check. But can you imagine you come back from London with a tremendous scoop on, say, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and then another one comes up and you have to go all the way back again. If you had a stringer there, which I've always had, then they can turn around. For instance, on the Duchess of Windsor, I had a brilliant stringer in Rome, Donatella Ottonia, who's with the New York Times Bureau in Rome, and I'd worked with her on various stories when I was working for the New York Times. And she found me, amazingly, the former ambassador to London, Count Grandi, because her father, Signor Ottella, had been his great close friend. So though he was blind and living at 96 in Bologna, she went up to the castle herself and got the story. So these stringers are, there's no way you can possibly improve on them. But you do have to double check the sources.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, but I did have a death threat from, just to be colorful, I had a death threat from the person who was the double, the stunt double of Errol Flynn. Well, not so much a death threat as an attempted death action to make it even better. Paul McWilliams, son of the famous cinematographer Glenn McWilliams, was an unsuccessful person. He began his life as Flynn's stunt double. Incredibly enough, when Flynn died, Flynn's 15-year-old mistress, Beverly Outland, married his double. Paul McWilliams. So she couldn't get the best, she got second best. Anyway, so she married him, and then he became very difficult, and she divorced him and remarried a used car salesman in Pacoima. Need I say more? So anyway, I went to see her. And it turned out that Paul McWilliams was furious with me for having exposed Errol Flynn's Nazi connections and became very threatening. So one night, we heard gunshots outside the house. I thought, coming from a generation when you still have backfires, that it might be a backfire. No, of course not. It was somebody shooting up my plants outside my front door. So I opened the door and looked out. Mind you, there's someone coming in right this minute, be careful. And I looked out the door, there was nothing visible. And then I got a shriek from Paul McWilliams saying, I'm going to come and get you. I said, well, the police will be here first, I've already called them. So he ran away. I didn't call the police at all, actually. He chickened out immediately. I thought, this is the measure of him. But then something happened. I got in my car, and instead of going comfortably up the hill, it went back down the hill. He'd done something to it. And I'm not sufficiently skilled as a motor engineer to tell you what. All I know is I went to... what he'd forgotten is that even if a car's going back down a hill, and I hope none of you have this experience, past or future, at least you can always steer a car. That's what they always forget. You can steer it off if it's going to go over a cliff. So I steered into the adjoining house, and the lady had 70,000 dollars worth of priceless ornaments on the other side of that wall, and not one of them fell. And all the worst I got was a battered fender. And I called Paul McWilliams and I said, look, this, I could easily hand this over to the police, but it would be an awful lot of hassle and headline news, and I haven't got time. I said, just don't do this again. He said, why not? I said, because of your son. The one thing in the world he cared about was he'd married a Japanese lady and he had a 9-year-old son. The only thing in the world he loved was that son, the half-Japanese son. I said, look, you may not care what happens to you. You're practically suicide already. But I said, if your son is in the headlines that a father tried to murder an author, it would destroy his whole life from school to college and on. And I never heard another word from him.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. So if any of you has a similar situation, you can use that.
Well, I think we're out of time. We're going to stop here, Charles. I've heard more. There are many more stories to be told, and I'm sure you'd be happy to share with them with you privately. As I said, books are for sale. If you'd like to get a signed copy of a Charles Higham book. There's 30 of them out there. You could collect the whole work. Thanks very much for being with us, Charles.